So here we are studying the Western Church from the 7th to the 9th century, and I will be honest, this is not my favorite portion of church history. I really enjoyed as we walked through Nicaea and we walked through some of the work that was done in Chalcedon and just these various great councils that occurred and how they debated and wrestled with these great and incredible doctrines of God, and just how we were able to see just the work of God even within these councils and even within the sinful ways they were organized and the sinful ways that and sometimes even in the way the council itself was orchestrated, but ultimately still wrestling with these deep theological truths. And in some ways, we're going to begin to step away from that. We're going to begin to get into missionary movement that is very much tied to a sword. We're going to get into theological debates that are just completely vacuous, totally useless, completely empty. And you have people who just won't even talk to each other because, you know, their monks cut their hair differently. And my hope is that we'll kind of, in some ways, obviously we're not to that degree in our lives, but we would still recognize ways in which we fall prey to some of these schisms, or just fall prey to just maybe focusing on something that maybe isn't that big of a deal. And certainly the way a monk cuts his hair is not within the category of what really matters. So we're going to begin in talking about the Celtic and Anglo-Saxon Christianity. There was a movement toward the English Isles very early on. Missionaries were sent up there at the very beginning, and they began to Christianize the English, even partway into Scotland, not quite to the northern portion, not really at all in Ireland. What happened is then you begin to have the Romans, as we had talked about, the Romans just kind of began to be bigger than they could really handle, and you begin to have barbarians invading from all sides. So what they had to do was begin to bring their troops closer in, because they didn't have the finances. And so as the troops began to move in, what that did was that it began to allow the Saxons and to come into England, and they began to take over. And so those were pagans. And those were pagan Saxons that came in and took over the English. And there was they were very much despised by the English Christians. And the English Christians were, for the most part, almost unwilling to do any kind of missionary outreach and activity. And that is a negative, and we need to recognize that's a negative. But I think also in a human perspective, when you have roving barbarians that come in and, you know, burn down your house and steal your wife and sell your children into slavery, sometimes, you know, that puts up certain walls that only the gospel of Jesus Christ can end up breaking through. So you don't have the English themselves ministering or sharing the gospel with these Saxon barbarians that came in, and you don't have that happen until this time period right here, right about the 4th and the 5th century. And we have a few that begin to walk in. We have the early Christians in Britain and in Ireland. As I mentioned, we get this early, from as early as the writings of Tertullian, that we had Christian Britons, Christians in the British Isles very early on. And it was basically soldiers, merchants, just people that traveled up there because that's where they wanted to live. And that's the way the Christianity was really, as far as we know, spread up to that area. There's two main ways that we know about it. We know some of the writings of early church fathers like Tertullian, and there's another man which we get most of what I'm talking about here about the British Isles is going to come from, a man named Bede. It's spelled B-E-D-E, and he wrote the history of England during this time period from about the 6th to the 8th century. There were three bishops that were sent from the Council of Arles that came to the Council of Arles, so they were from England. So that's 4th century, 314, that we had some. We have another man by the name of Ninian. St. Ninian was an apostle to Scotland. As I had said, Scotland had not been pushed far, very, very far into, and Ninian went forward into Scotland. He was a British man. He was trained in Rome. He was very much cultured as a Roman, and he went into Scotland as a missionary. However, it wasn't very long before it was the Irish, actually, that were sending missionaries into Scotland. And it's on account of the work of this man here is a man named St. Patrick. He was born into a Christian family in northwest England, which I find that actually interesting. This is the patron saint of Ireland, and the patron saint of Ireland is actually an Englishman, maybe even Scottish, some suppose, but he was not Irish. And here's how he ended up in Ireland. He was actually kidnapped by pirates at a very young age, sold into slavery in Ireland. He had to work as a shepherd. He was a slave who was a shepherd for many, many years. And the story goes that he was very despondent, very, very, very scared for obvious reasons, very concerned over what would happen to him. And supposedly he was praying like 100 times a day, which as a shepherd, I would imagine that you had a whole lot of time to sit out there and pray as you were sitting there with your sheep. I find it fascinating that he was a shepherd when you look at the history of shepherds throughout Scripture. He ended up escaping to Gaul. He escaped on a ship that was full of Irish hounds, and somehow he was able to work on the ship to pay for his passageway there. Just, I don't know if you've ever seen Irish hounds. They're some incredible dogs. They're very, very tall. They're nice with people, but they are not nice if you're like a wolf. That's what they were used to. That's what they were used to fight against. However, the story goes St. Patrick ended up having a dream, and he had a dream in that in his dream he was given a series of letters. He began to read one of the letters, and it was a letter from someone in Ireland asking him to come back, and he pushed this away, desiring not to go back to this area, and he continued to feel the call that he was to go to Ireland. And by the way, I skipped the part. When he was in Gaul, he ended up studying in a monastery. Patrick was very much liked asceticism, and he very much took on the life of the monks, and so much so took on the life of the monks that instead of priests being the primary leaders within an area and bishops being the primary leaders within an area, it was the monks and it was the abbots, which were the leaders of the monastery. And they considered the leaders to be monks in such ways that whenever from Ireland they would write to the Pope, they would call him the head abbot. They're the only ones that called him that. He went to an area that was extremely pagan. The Celtic gods were, it was very regular to do human sacrifices. And he kind of laid out this, not the best way to present the gospel, but he laid out this picture of a god, basically the god of three faces. And he portrayed Christ as greater than the pagan gods. And this is a common way that the gospel is presented during this time period is that the God of Christianity is greater than these pagan gods. These pagan gods are very much empty. They're vacuous. There's nothing ultimately there within them. And the Christian God is greater. And the way that he portrayed Christ as being greater was that he said that these pagan gods are asking you to give a human sacrifice to them out of their anger. But God in his love poured his wrath out upon Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ fully took upon himself this punishment that all of us deserve. And Christianity spread throughout Ireland. And I actually misspoke. Ireland had been somewhat Christianized previously, but the Germanic tribes had very much taken over the population. And so pretty much when he got there, Ireland was completely, completely pagan. Characteristics of Celtic Christianity. They, as I said, they had a very cultivated monastic life. He was one that came from a monastic branch, so he very much pushed that into it. It was associated with clan life, not as much broken into a diocese, but rather broken up into various clans. And we had seen that previously when we talked about the barbarians, that's how they were basically broken up. Many times they weren't broken up into this bishop or that bishop. You were broken up into this clan or that clan, which makes sense when you think about nomadic peoples moving around. You're not thinking about a land. I'm stuck in this place, at this building, at this church. Why would I bother making this great building that we would meet in when we're going to move around somewhere else when the sheep need to go to another area? They're characterized by missionary zeal. They taught that each Christian should communicate the gospel to others. Another aspect of it was very focused on penance, and they had a slightly different view on penance than some of the Roman Christians. Their view on penance was more of a private penance, and there was a book that was written that the Irish Christians would follow that basically whenever you did a particular sin, so instead of going to the priest and confessing it, you would look it up in that book, and it would, you know, okay, I need to do this, and then you would go do that on your own. It was kind of a do-it-yourself penance, and there was actually great debates that were occurring between the Roman Church and the Celtic Church over this. Additionally, they had their own dating of Easter, which is going to be very controversial, and there's going to be a whole Senate that convenes so that they can try to figure out exactly what day are we supposed to have Easter upon, and they're not going to talk to each other for a while because they don't agree. Pope Gregory became very interested in converting the English early on, and Pope Gregory saw young English boys. This is another small story, but Pope Gregory, it is said, was standing in England, and he saw a series of young boys who were being sold into slavery. And he said, "What are they?" And they said, "Oh, they're Angles," meaning like Anglo-Saxons. And he says, "Say not Angles, but rather angels." And it's believed that he always had a heart for England, and he worked really hard to send missionaries to England. One of the prominent ones that he sent was a man named Augustine of Canterbury. This is not the St. Augustine of Hippo. This is a different man. But Augustine of Canterbury, he sent him along with 40 other monks. They landed in southwestern England in an area, and the lord or the king over that particular area was actually married to the great-great-granddaughter of Clovis, who was the king of the Franks. You remember, Clovis had converted to Christianity. So you had a woman who was Christian married to a man who was pagan. And he was the king of Kent. The king of Kent said that they could do their missionary activities. However, they were not allowed to use any coercion to get converts. The king of Kent ended up converting in the year of 597, and he actually had gone through a series of different religions. Which one should I pick? And he ended up picking Christianity, probably from the influence of his wife. Augustine was a friar in Rome. He reached Canterbury about 597, which shortly after the king was baptized. This is a map of England. So, you know, Northumbria is that area that we were just speaking of. There's Scotland, and there's Ireland. Another interesting story about Augustine of Canterbury, he had actually told the people that when they were reaching out in missionary activities towards the Romans, if the Romans were to come to them in humility, that they were to be accepted as men of God. However, if they did not come in humility, then they were to be shunned and they were to be rejected. And so when bishops in the area came and approached him, because you had this, there was this little schism that existed there, because you had these Christians that had been there since the second and third century, and then you had these new guys that came on the block. And so when these old bishops came up and to meet with Augustine, he didn't stand up. And so they took that as basically saying, okay, well, you don't have the humility to stand when we come into your presence. And they walked away and they listened to nothing that he said. And this is going to go on for a couple hundred years, that there's going to be a schism between these two groups of Christianity, because you still have old wounds that are there between these Saxons that had come in and raided the English. And, you know, I guess maybe a little bit of a Jonah syndrome there. It's not really your great desire to see these people, because that's something very similar that had happened with the Ninevites. They were a very warrior-like and ravenous people that perhaps that's why Jonah had not desired to see them converted. But that certainly is the reason that happened here with the early Christians in England. So developments in Northumbria, that's that northern area right there, there was a great controversy, and this is... And just think about it. We've gone from Council of Nicaea discussing the oneness of God, the Council of Constantinople discussing the threeness of God, the Council of Ephesus, we're discussing the oneness of Christ. And then in Chalcedon, we're discussing the two-ness of Christ, the fact that Christ is fully human and fully man. And now we're going to have this sign out here, because there's a great controversy here. The Celtic Christians celebrated Easter. Now pay attention. You might want to write this down in your notes. Celtic Christians celebrated Easter on the Sunday between the 14th and the 20th day of the moon. And the Roman Christians celebrated Easter on the Sunday between the 15th and the 21st day. Which I actually think, by my estimations there, they were actually celebrating Easter on the same day a lot of years. It's just that apparently some years that they weren't. And so you've got a one-day difference to the left or to the right that they are differing. They additionally had another great controversy that they had to meet and have a council over, and that's the Roman clergy would shave their heads in the form of a crown. They basically shave this area right here, and the Celtic Christians would shave just the front of their head. So we've gone now from debating divinity of Christ, the humanity of Christ. Now we're nitpicking over the dates of Easter, and it's just a vacuous debate. And what it does, it reminds me almost of some of the debates that you'll see amongst the Amish, where you'll see them debating over, well, what type of a buggy should you have, or what kind of rein should be upon your horse, or even what type of suspenders should a man be wearing. And that's about where they are right now. They're debating over the haircuts of a monk, and they are debating over what day that they should be celebrating Easter, neither of which are of any significance whatsoever. But I want us to keep ourselves in check here. I want us to do a little self-reflection, and I want us to think about this. Are there ways in which we project or focus upon something that's not prescribed in Scripture? And I'm not saying that someone can't be different. I mean, ultimately, the haircut, if you want to cut your hair that way, that's your own business. But it wasn't something that a council needed to be held over how this was to be done. This debate, however, was finally settled, and it was settled because the Roman Christians pointed back to the Pope having his authority through Peter himself. And when that was brought up, the Celts submitted. They said, okay, well, we don't want to stand against Peter. Bede is the one I mentioned earlier. He was a great historian of the time. He was one of the few people in England that knew Greek. Actually, many of the Roman people had stopped in the Western Church, had not known Greek as well. And you're going to see works coming out of Ireland and England during this time that are theological writings that you weren't seeing in that Western portion of the church. And I think perhaps maybe it was because there wasn't as much war going on at the time. As we talked about earlier, it is a luxury to have the ability to sit around and to have theological debates and to have theological study. And when you have, you know, houses being burned down, and you have kings coming in and just, you know, pillaging, you're just trying to stay alive. And so having councils, having theological discussions, even if you went through the trouble of copying large books, you know, they got burnt down in the midst of an attack. But most of what we're talking about here in the English area comes from this man named Bede. He also he's the first one that used in historical writing the BC AD system, placing zero. Actually, it wasn't a zero, but placing the one at the birth of Christ. He's not the one that came up with it, but he's the one that officially started using it. So the Anglo-Saxons' missions on the continent, they began to send missionaries outward. And Anglo-Saxons' missionaries worked to create Roman Catholic Christianity within England and throughout the continent of and throughout the European continent. And they worked through many different strategies. Many of these strategies, what I want us to gather out of this, is that these are very consistent Roman Catholic strategies that they used throughout time, and there are even Roman Catholic strategies that are used today. One of the aspects that they'll do is they'll look at paganism. They'll kind of consider paganism that's already there, and they'll kind of reflect on, okay, now what can we glean out of this? What can we kind of use with this? And it's not uncommon that you'll have some kind of a pagan deity, and it'll be switched, maybe repainted a little bit, but in very similar fashion, well, this will be Peter. And now this one over here, this will be Mary. And so that's what they'll do. They'll try to consider what's salvageable and what is completely incompatible with Christianity. And what's salvageable, they'll synchronize with Christianity. We would call it synchronization, just the fact that they're doing this. They would only call it synchronization if it's directly contradicting one of their tenets that they want to hold on to. So their strategy is they would work directly under the Pope, which worked very well with them because, as we had mentioned, the Pope was kind of someone that transcended. Although he didn't have authority everywhere, he did kind of have a tradition and authority that extended beyond a political boundary. And the Pope used that for his advantage, and the various kings, leaders, and missionaries all used that for their advantage as well. They also worked under the protection of local rulers that had positives and negatives. The first one is that it could make them appear as an enemy power. So this is something that has happened historically in Christianity, where you'll have someone who is under they look as though they are under a particular governing body, and they're Christians, and that governing body just raided a particular area, and now the missionaries come in, and then it's hard not to look at them in the same way. Sometimes that happens when Americans go into the Middle East. I think in the Tang Dynasty in China, that was particularly a problem. You had Christians in that time period, and then once that Tang Dynasty was removed, the church kind of dissipated because it was really difficult to separate the one from the other. They challenged the pagan gods. I basically argued and claimed that there was just mere superstition here. Boniface is one of them. Boniface is a Englishman. He was the missionary to the Germans. And one of the famous things that he did was there was this great oak tree to Thor. And it was said that if anyone ever cut down this tree to Thor, that I should have found a painting of this. I'm sure there is one. But if anyone had ever cut down this tree or messed with this tree at all, that, you know, Thor was going to strike him down. And he was having great difficulty in sharing the gospel and ministering to people. And so he took an axe and he just began to chop away on this giant oak tree. And they all stood around just waiting for him to get struck by lightning at any time. And the oak tree fell. And people began to convert at that point. But it required that oak tree falling before they would listen to him. They offered catechism type instruction. They also did mass conversions. So this is nothing new. They will pick a day like Easter or like Pentecost and wait for everyone to gather around there, and they'll do mass conversions and do mass baptisms at that time period. They also organized dioceses and parishes, but not so much in the Irish areas. Two other missionaries. Let's go on to the age of Charlemagne. Age of Charlemagne. Let's start off with Charlemagne's predecessors. Charles Martel was the Merovian king. He was a warrior king. He halted the Muslims' advances into France. That's one of the things that this whole dynasty did, was they kind of kept the barbarians from the north. They tried that. They weren't always successful. They expanded the lands, and they kept the Muslims from invading any farther. They kept them back into some of the German areas and kept them out of France. He had actually secularized church property in order to fund his endeavors. As you go through this line, they're going to become more and more enmeshed and entrenched within the papacy itself. There's Charles Martel. Next, you have Charlemagne. Charlemagne and Pippin, he's known as Pippin the Short, were both the sons that succeeded Charles Martel. Charlemagne ended up becoming a monk in a monastery. Pippin the Short is the one succeeded him. And it's with him that you began to have a very direct tie between the papacy and the kingship. He decided to have a confirmation for his kingship by the church. So in 754, Pope Stephen anointed Pippin and also his sons. Afterward, it just became very commonplace for the Pope to anoint whoever had become king, or later on whoever became emperor. And they would actually use the same oil that was used for anointing a bishop. And in response to Pepin being basically ordained by the Pope, Pippin granted Pope Stephen what's known as the Byzantinian Corridor. And he basically, some have argued that the king gave this to the Pope. It depends on which side you're on. Others argue that the Pope already owned it and that he was merely just granting that to them. But now the Pope actually had a solid piece of land that he could kind of call his own country here. And however, it's always easy to be benevolent with things that don't actually belong to you, right? I mean, we've seen that with people that work within our government. It's very, very easy to be giving and benevolent with something that doesn't belong to you. And this land actually belonged to the Eastern Empire. But Pippin argued that the Eastern Emperor had not done a good job in taking care of the people in that area, and they were not well protected by the barbarians. And it's on that basis that he gave this on to the Pope. Pippin died in 768. He was succeeded by Charles the Great. He died in 771. And then he was succeeded by Charlemagne. And Charlemagne was inspired by the Augustine's book, The City of God. And based on reading The City of God, he, by the way, missed the point of The City of God. But he took it upon himself to say, you know what, I need to create basically a Frankish-Roman empire. And it's, like I said, it's ironic because the whole point of the book is that the city of God is not actually made up of these cities of man. It was actually an apologetic about the fact that God was still at work here despite the fact that the Roman Empire was falling. But that's where he got it from. Charlemagne was a military man. He was also a missionary man. So he decided to send military and missionaries sometimes at the same time, sometimes one before the other, but he very much was trying to send both. He began to expand his empire. He solidified the western portion of the empire. He struggled throughout his reign with the northern portion, with the Saxons coming in through the north, but he was successful in holding back in the encroaching barbarians. His main foes were the Germanic Saxons. He began to send missionaries as he invaded the Saxons, and he did that for 33 years. He would send missionaries and send warriors into the Saxon territory. How many of you think this missionary strategy worked really well? It wasn't, and you're not going to find any books if you go into Lifeway on this particular missionary strategy. It was not successful because he had not conquered them with the sword, so the missionaries weren't successful either. But he was continually sending missionaries out to the pagan tribes. I want us to see with here, like, we just have a significant problem with a sphere of authority. There are spheres of authority that the Lord has given in institutions that exist, and you have the government that the Lord has put there, and there's particular authority that the governing bodies are given. And you have the church, and there's particular authority that the church is given. And what you're having here is just a mess. You're having the Pope trying to be the governing authority, and now you're having Charlemagne here. He's trying to be basically the church authority, and it's messy. It's a big mess, and I think none of this ever would have happened if we didn't have this idea of a hierarchy within the church. You would not have this issue of popes and archbishops and all these various people working with the governing structures in to this degree. Not that it doesn't happen even within some of our evangelicals in this country at times, it seems, but not to this degree, even close. Missionaries were part of his military and objective. He would invade and then demand that everyone be baptized. So he would invade, everyone had to be baptized. In the late 700s, he actually made it a capital offense not to baptize your children. It was required. You didn't baptize your children. It was basically a sign of paganism. You could be put to death for that. And reaching out to the Saxons, they'd kind of changed the stories. He was okay with changing stuff, and this is going to end up being a problem between him and I think it's Pope Leo III. We'll get to it in a minute. But he's actually more open to kind of allowing some of the Gaelic into the liturgy, and the Pope wants to keep it in Latin. And the same thing here with the Saxons. He kind of changed the stories of the Gospels in such a way that Jesus' disciples were rather his warrior companions, because they were trying to make a story that the Saxons would be more willing to accept. He did not allow any other religions in his kingdom, with the exception of Judaism. Judaism is the only other religion that he allowed. It's the only one that was allowed under Charlemagne's rule within Charlemagne's empire. As far as we can tell, they live peaceably amongst them within the Christians within Charlemagne's empire. There's his empire. Oh. So Charlemagne basically considered himself to be like a King David. He believed that he was placed over the spiritual life and the secular life of the people. And one side story that I found fascinating is that when Boniface had gone into Germany, he had translated the Bibles into the Germanic language. But he left out 1 and 2 Kings, and he said he said the Saxons didn't need any more of a reason to start another war. And he said he figured having 1 and 2 Kings in their language would just lead them to justify so many of their military expansions. But Charlemagne very much considered himself to be like a King David, believing that he was spreading Christianity in a way that King David had worked within the Promised Land. Not the same thing. Charlemagne sought to establish order in the church. And so, of course, you have a king, and he's an executive leader. He's a ruler over military. So you're going to have a military view of order. And a military view of order is going to have a hierarchy. And the hierarchy is always going to have to be loyal to the king, which is something that he demanded from those that were in the clergy at that time. And so he would basically place people in as bishops. He'd put people in as abbots. He'd place people within their various areas of authority. I believe the pope at this time was actually elected. Charlemagne required the clergy to wear liturgical garments at all time, and one of the reasons why he desired that, at the time they could wear more common clothes when they weren't officiating, and even when they were officiating sometimes they didn't always wear liturgical garments, but he wanted them to wear liturgical garments so that they'd have to stick out if they were in a brothel or a tavern. Charlemagne also sought to bring order to the liturgy. He began to bring in some of the Gregorian chant liturgy, brought in some of the Gaelic influence. I was reflecting on this, and I just thought, can you imagine if the President of the United States was coming up with our order of worship, if he was picking out the songs that we would read on a Sunday morning or picking out the scriptures that we would be reading? But that's kind of what you had here. You had this emperor working within to create a liturgy. Charlemagne made rules. He made tithing mandatory. The state was basically enforcing others to pay tithes to the church. Something that in some ways, I mean, I think in a backdoor, this still happens in Great Britain, in that you still have taxation that's taken from people, and some of that taxation actually goes to the Church of England. He made working on Sunday illegal. Confessing sins and communion was required. It was required 3 times a year that you take communion and that you confess your sins. And something I've always thought, I haven't seen this historically, but I've always thought that if you had an emperor or a king who was forcing people to confess their sins, that would always be, a great source of power here. Like, you could actually hold some of these sins that someone committed over someone's head and say, hey, I know you did this. And if you don't act this way, that way, or that way, that there's going to be a consequence for this because I have evidence of this. Just a thought. Baptizing of children and giving them a Christian name was mandatory. And baptism at this time was administered through triple immersion. So they would take a baby and they would, not everyone, but most of them at this time period, they would basically, in the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and they would do these baptisms on Easter or Pentecost. The only time they would do an exception to those was if someone was bedridden. paganism was still basically flourishing amongst the baptized Christians. And that shouldn't be surprising that you have people that are Christians. You have people here that think that in some way being dipped in water magically forgave their sins or in some way is going to make them in a right standing with God. And so you have very much paganism mixed within here because everyone has to be a Christian. So you're going to have, when you have a system where everyone has to be a Christian, you're going to have people that think they're Christians that absolutely aren't Christians. He also worked to establish schools and an intellectual renaissance. His desire was to establish schools through the monasteries. He wasn't incredibly successful at this because there was just a lot going on. There was a lot going on at this time period, and he did not create the amount of schools that he desired, but he wanted this to be done through the monks. Remember, it was the monasteries that began to take on some of these social services that previously were taken care of by the Roman government. And when Rome began to fall, the monasteries were kind of already in their place, and they just began to take over caring for the poor, educating the young. Charlemagne had a belief that right knowledge would lead to right action. And so that was his belief, was that so many of the people within his territory were following after these false beliefs and this incorrect doctrine. They were doing that on account that they had a faulty belief. They did not believe right. So he had sought scholars from Italy, France, England, and he had sent them out to spread this knowledge throughout the empire. And his desire was especially that the pastors, now that's scary, but his desire was that the pastors would have knowledge of the scriptures. And that's really, really important. I think that's just plain scary that you had people operating pastorates at this time, some of which were illiterate, some of which did not know the scriptures at all. And these were the ones that were placed over leading people. Theological developments of the time. There was a debate over the nature of Christ. There was some Spanish at the time, and they call it adoptionism, and it's not the same thing as the Nestorian heresy that we had discussed, but they had a belief that the human nature of Christ was adopted by the Father. And they ended up being called out as heretics over that. Gaelic was then placed in the liturgy, although Pope Leo continued to fight against it. And there was also a debate over the use of art. The Pope at the time basically wanted all art that wasn't Christian completely destroyed. And Charlemagne was very much a Renaissance man. So he did not want anyone to worship pagan images. He did not want anyone to use any of these as idols. But at the same time, he believed that having art in itself was okay. And so he basically made an executive decision over the Pope and said that they could keep their artwork. Pope Leo III ended up coronating Charlemagne on Christmas Day of the year 800. I'm sure you have a homeschool song that goes along with that day. Charlemagne had desired a title, but he wasn't real happy with how this turned out, because basically what it ended up appearing like was that Pope Leo had just made Charlemagne king. And Charlemagne was very adamant that that is not what was happening. Pope Leo was acknowledging his kingship, was acknowledging him as this Roman emperor. This wasn't something that the Pope could just hand to someone and then hand to someone else. It's actually because there was kind of a deal that was going on here, because Pope Leo was under suspicion of adultery. He was going to be brought in for a trial, and it stated that on account of doing this, that Charlemagne was going to accept Pope Leo's innocence based upon his own confession, not have a trial. But this didn't work out for Charlemagne. So Charlemagne, actually, before he died, he had his own son crowned apart from the Pope. So before he died, he had his son, who is known as Louis the Pious, I think is his name, Louis the Pious, crowned himself, and then allowed, after Charlemagne died, the Pope was allowed to give him a coronation, but it was made clear that the Pope's not the one that had done that. However, That is what happened. There ended up being, after Charlemagne, there ended up being a very, very strong enmeshing of the Pope, and the Pope began to have more and more power over the secular leaders. This is the son, Louis the Pious. So later on, after Charlemagne, let's talk about the political background that occurred after Charlemagne. The emperor began to have a supreme rule. During this time, it was believed the emperor had supreme rule. The pope had more of a territorial rule. As we already said, the pope was actually elected during this time period. However, things began to get broken up after Louis the Pious died. So Louis the Pious, he's called Louis the Pious because he was very much tied in with the pope and with the clergy itself, and he was very much, in many ways, allowing himself to be influenced by them. He died. There he has three sons that were taken over. You have Charles the Bald. All these guys have different names. Lothar, and then his other son, Louis. And basically the way this worked out is he had three sons. There was almost a war that occurred between the three of them over who was going to control what territory. And that always fascinates me. You have someone that was your sibling your entire life, and now you're placed over this gigantic region of territory. You rule all these people. You excise taxes from these people. You can have pretty much whatever you want, but then you just kind of look over there and say, but I don't have that. And so you're willing to kill your own sibling so that you can have that piece of land. It just makes me think of two children standing in the living room just yanking on a toy, and that's almost what's happening there as they fight over this little piece of land when they already have so much. But Charles the Bald ended up ruling over the western portion of France. Lothar ruled over the middle area, down through Italy. And Louis ruled over the eastern German area. And there began to be more and more influence over the papacy. And as things broke up, you had the Pope that had authority over these multiple different areas. And this is one of the reasons why the Pope would claim he had this particular authority. And this is a complete sham. This is a complete lie, and it was used for centuries to argue for the supremacy of the Roman Pope and the supremacy of the Roman Pope over both the Eastern Church, over all church authorities, and even over the secular rulings of the Western portion of the empire. And so what you have here is known as the Pseudo-Isidorian Decrees, and it's the basis of the Pope's authority, and it goes on for, like I said, hundreds of years. Within this group of these pseudo-Isidorian decretals, you had papal communications. They were basically known as apostolic canons. And you have 60 different decrees that are written by various church fathers and by Clement of Rome. And they argued for the basis of papal authority. They're all forgeries. None of these are true. None of these are legitimate. They were used for years. And I know they knew it. They knew these were forgeries. They knew these weren't true. You have another one known as the there's a picture of one of them. You have the Donation of Constantine, and this basically teaches that Pope Sylvester healed Constantine right whenever he converted, and shortly after Constantine was healed, Constantine moved the capital to Constantinople, and he did that so that the Pope would have rule over the western portion of the empire. And so it teaches that the Pope is the one that actually crowned Constantine as emperor. That's not how the story went. Remember, Constantine moved his capital from the west to the east because you had the Persians that were invading on the east, and he wanted to be on the eastern portion so that he could keep a front there. It wasn't because any of this happened. This legend actually gained acceptance during the 5th century, and there was a forgery that was created. It was circulated during the 8th century. And this story just went on for years. Here's actually a painting of that fictitious event. Next, you have the canons of the Council of Nicaea. Those were actually authentic, but they would use aspects of those to argue for the supremacy of the Western Pope. And lastly, you had letters of the Pope from Sylvester through Gregory II, basically trying to make an argument that, see, this has been going on the whole time period. We've had the Western Pope that was the supreme ruler this whole time. All forgeries. All forgeries. Pope Nicholas the Great, he's actually the first pope that appealed to the pseudo-Isidorian decrees as the basis for the Pope's authority. He used this as a basis to argue against King Lothair. He was the one that had the central portion, and he had to take him back, argued that he, on the basis of the pseudo-Isidorian decrees and on the basis of the Pope having authority, that he had to go back with his first wife. Of course, he could have just looked at the Bible and made an appeal from that as well, not from a forgery. There was a controversy over the Lord's Supper from Anselm, and you begin to kind of have this transubstantiation picture with a man named, I'm going to mess up his name, Pasacius Radbertius. He actually made an argument for transubstantiation and actually lined it up clearly that what happens is that whenever you consume the bread and the wine, it very literally in all places everywhere at the time when it occurs actually becomes the literal body and blood of Christ. And this was controversial amongst many that rather decided to take more of a spiritual view on it. But I wanted to bring this up because you kind of see that. This is beginning to become more and more entrenched. We have a man here, I couldn't find his name, but I like him. He ended up being denounced as a heretic, and he was banished. I don't know if he banished himself or if they banished him. But his name was Godstalk, and he was the son of a Saxon count. He was given as an oblate in a monastery. An oblate is basically someone who is given to the monastery at a very young age, and then they grow up and they will stay in a monastic life. There were different rules on it. I think at one time period, you had to stay throughout your life, and then during another time period, it was changed, and you were given a choice. But during his time period, he had no choice. He ended up becoming a monk and an itinerant preacher, and he was one who was a big fan of Augustine, and a big fan of Augustine, especially in the soteriology. So he taught a view of predestination, and very much consistent, from what I can tell, from what I've read of him, seems to be a very consistent teaching of Jesus and Paul of what the Bible teaches. It was controversial, and the doctrines were condemned at the Synod of Kersey in 849 and 853. But one thing that we do have out of this is that you have Augustinianism still alive, because if there wasn't an acceptance of Augustinianism, there wouldn't have been people who were calling him to come and preach. And so what we have here is we have a very, very awkward time in church history where there is a very big focus on minors instead of majors. You also have just an incredible misunderstanding about where spheres of authority is, exactly where the church's sphere of authority is, and then furthermore, exactly where the king's authority is. And you have what basically is just a framework that has been set up, a foundation that has been laid, and you have basically the frame of what's going to be the Middle Ages, and this is going to support it until we get to the Reformation, and it goes back to so much of what was done during this time period.